Well, welcome to our day five review of the World Athletics Championships. I'm here with Dr. Ross Tucker, as we have been the whole week. And it's been an exciting and interesting World Championships, and we've been analysing some of the stories behind the stories and some of the controversies that have been happening at the World Athletics Championships. The stuff that you don't see on TV, because we're not paid by the IAAF to say nice things all the time, and we're here to hopefully give a very unbiased and objective view about what is happening at the World Athletics Championship. So a big thank you to everybody for participating, not only on Twitter. Of course, Ross is on Twitter at Science of Sport, and you can tweet him. He has been having some very vociferous Twitter conversations with some of the English media and personalities on his account at the moment this morning. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And we'll talk a bit about what happened last night, some of the biggest finals of the World Championships, the steeplechase, the 800 meters, and the 400 meters, all the men's events yesterday. And then we'll preview a little bit about what's going to be happening tonight and tell you a little bit about what it's like to run the 400 meter hurdles, one of the most technical events at the World Championships, and how people like Edwin Moses used to do it, and how that has made the event such an interesting event to watch tonight. So stay tuned. We'll be here with you for probably just over the next half an hour. And don't forget, the podcast will be loaded up on our site a little bit later on. And you can download that and listen to it anywhere you want. You can listen to it in the car, wherever you are today. So let's start off with the review of last night's steeplechase. We'll start with that event first. A beautiful event to watch. Of course, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, Ross, in saying that maybe the Kenyans might not even get a medal. In the end, it was a victory for Kenya, consensus Kipruto. But it wasn't plain sailing for the Kenyans, as we usually see.
No, it wasn't. And we thought maybe there was a chance that they wouldn't get a medal, but in the end they got the one that mattered.
Yeah.
And so maintain what we discovered was a 19 championship win streak for Kenyan born men. Mm. Twice in the vest of Qatar, but nevertheless born in Kenya. So Kipruto, I was reading about it this morning, has apparently only done one track session since he won the Kenyan champs in June, and he hadn't finished a race since then either. Mm. Because of a foot injury. So he went into that, by his own words, having a lot of doubts about whether he could beat Jaeger and the Moroccan. Mm. But he said he woke up that morning and he said to himself, maybe when he was brushing his teeth, he looked in the mirror, he said, I'm the Olympic champion and I'm going to win this. So then he did. And it was an odd race because it was underwhelmingly slow for the gaps that were created. You know, like they went 2:51 through the first K and then 2:43, and that none of those times are, these guys run those times for the entire race normally.
Yeah.
But even that pace, it split the group, and there were only three left. And then Kipruto, over the last 300 meters, is the best guy. So he did what he had to do.
To some extent, it was Jaeger, the American, that actually made the running. He was the one who set the pace. He blew off Ezekiel Kemboi, who was the former bronze medal at the Olympics last year. Mm-hmm. Eventually got disqualified for a lane infringement. Mm-hmm. But it looked like he had the measure of the Kenyans at one point, and that he was the dominant athlete until Kipruto came through.
Yeah, so he said afterwards that he thought that it would be slow in the first kilometre. Mm-hmm. And then the plan was, so they did have a plan and they executed it. The plan was to then go to the front and make the pace honest. Mm. Mm. Because Jaeger's own words were, he felt like he was the strongest steeplechaser in that race. Mm. Which the year suggests is accurate, because as I said yesterday, he was the fastest in the world this year by about 3-4 seconds. Mm. And so he would have wanted it to be quick. So he did that. Mm. But in doing so, and we discussed this in the context of those 1500 meter tactics, he basically played the role of a pacemaker to the guys behind him. And when they went to the front with 2:50 to go, he had nothing left. And so he was, in the end, quite comfortably beaten. Mm. And I was surprised. I thought that he would have more than that over the whole race and over the final 2:50. Mm. I thought all three would actually have more. I thought it would take more to win that. And so I was underwhelmed at the performance.
Interesting that Ezekiel Kemboi, who's kind of a bit of a personality when it comes to steeplechasing. When he actually is in the race, you often see him sort of playing to the crowd and running to the front and setting a pace and disrupting the rhythm of the event. You know, this is an interesting sort of tactic that he has. We saw a bit of that from Consensus Kipruto as he was coming down the straight. He knew he had the win, although I always think it's a risky game to play, started playing to the crowd and playing the sort of game with a bit of a mad look in his eye. But the Kenyans, I mean, there's no doubt they are incredibly entertaining to watch in the steeplechase.
In the steeplechase, I don't know what it is about steeplechase attracts the entertainers, because you never see that from the 5 and the 10K and the marathon guys. But the steeplechase, they like a bit of a dance and a party afterwards. Mm. So Kenboy said to Kipruto afterwards, "Your turn, you take the baton from me now," which is a bit late because he's already the Olympic champ, Kipruto. So that has now firmly been handed over to him. So he's the guy to beat, and Kenboy didn't get his medal. The only reason Kenboy was in that race was because he'd been disqualified in the Olympic Games and came back, in his own words at the time, to claim what belonged to him.
And well, he was disqualified for stepping out of his lane.
Right, so as they came off one of the water jumps, you know, the water jumps on the inside of the track was the case in Rio, he just took on maybe his third step after the jump, he took a step left and touched the line. And the French appealed that and had Kenboy disqualified. Interestingly, they did the same thing last night, the French, because their guy came fourth and they made the same play of appealing a lane infringement against Jaeger, who'd been third. So exactly the same script that they ran in Rio, and I'm pleased to say that they got away with it in Rio, but I'm glad they didn't last night. I think it was a joke then, and it would have been the same last
night. Because last night, essentially what the IWF decided was that he didn't cut the corner by stepping out of the lane, and it was only marginally over the line. It was actually on the line.
Right, so no advantage gained. It's on the straight part.
Yeah.
And over a race of 3,000 metres, step on a line on a straight bit. So it's like, and I suppose we can talk about lane infringements because there've now been a few.
Yeah.
But
in fact, more than I ever remember at a World Championships, bizarrely. Yeah.
So there's a law, but I like the idea of using common sense. Right? And so I'm quite happy with the rulings they've made. But in Rio, I think they got it wrong.
Yeah. So in fact, I was on a local radio station at 7:02 here yesterday, and they asked me the same question. Why was the South African sprinter Claude Monnier racing in the 200-meter heats disqualified because of a lane infringement? Yes, Mo Farah, who quite clearly went into the lane during the 10,000 meters, wasn't. And how I explained it best was Monnier was racing in the 200 meters, so being slightly over your lane means that you do essentially effectively have an advantage, and you have to make sure you stay in your lane in the 200 meters because that's probably the challenge of the event. Whereas in the case of Mo Farah, he was racing the 10,000, he was in fact pushed a bit, and it was an intentional foot out, and it gained him no advantage whatsoever. Right. So that's really the rule.
Yeah, so the Farah thing was obviously quite a story. People saying, come on, double standards here. But and yes, I think by the letter of the law, but the fact that there was jostling going on and he got a little bit of a bump, stepped off and then straight back on, I'm quite happy that medals are not decided by that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There have been in the 200 medals decided by that. Martina, I think the year that Bolt won in Beijing, my recollection of years and events is hazy, but he was actually disqualified from a medal position for a lane infringement in turn. So they pay attention to it.
Yeah.
But in a distance race, for me, it doesn't sit well when you decide a medal based on something like that.
Yeah. So come on, the French. We're not sure why you always want to protest these things, but maybe if you'd like to give us your view on that, you can tweet us or put a comment on our Facebook page and let us know what you thought about that particular story behind the story. Let's move on to the 800 meters. I guess we talked about this yesterday, Ross, and you were saying that the race is wide open. There's eight athletes that could win it. In the end, it was the Frenchman Ambroise Boss who won it, and a fairly average race in terms of time, but exciting to watch.
Yeah, because so open. No dominant athlete this year who's been consistently good, so who knew what was going to happen coming in. It went pretty much according to script. I think in the semis, McBride and Bett had both taken on the work of leading the race in the beginning, and that happened in the final with the Canadian doing that job. And you'd have thought guys like Amos would have been quite happy with that because the pace was honest.
This is Nigel Amos, the Botswana athlete.
This is Nigel Amos, who was going into it the highest ranked athlete in that final on time. And he'd looked really impressive in some fast races in early June, July. So you'd have thought this is looking good for Amos, but you know, 50, just under 51 at the Bell, and then going into the back straight, obviously it's quite congested.
So 51, let's put it in context, that it's an average time. It's not super fast, it's not super slow, it's kind of
49, low 49 is world record tempo. And so they are off that, but it's decent, because off of 51 you are looking at a 144 with a decent second lap. And so what was surprising last night was off that 51 they still ran 144 high. And so there weren't fireworks on the second lap. And Boss takes the lead. He takes the initiative down the back straight, and he's at the front with 200 to go, and he's he builds a lead despite not being spectacularly fast. So in a wide open race, no one really came through with a performance to except for Boss, obviously.
Amos was pushed around a lot. I mean, early in the race, he nearly tripped twice, literally within the first couple of 100 meters. So he was, and he was the guy they were looking at. But again, as he came around that sort of final 200 meters, he was in the wrong position. He was probably a bit wide, and that, I mean, he had to feel for him. He was right in the middle positions with 15 meters to go, and then suddenly went down to fifth. You know,
he's I was going to say ugly to look at, because technically, you know, his arms are going in the wrong directions, and his arms go, and so it's not ugly, it's just different, right? And he looks ungainly. But he has done since he ran 141.7 in London 2012. So, but he seems to me in these championship races to really underperform. Ever since that, as a teenager, he's not been able to do anything at a majors again. And I don't know whether it's tension, whether he can't handle the slower races. You know, in London in 2012, Rudisha was the pace setter. Went through 49-something at the Bell and then kept going. So it was basically a paced race, and all he had to do was hang on. But he doesn't seem to handle himself very well. So that would have been a big disappointment on a night where Botswana, you know, we said yesterday this was Botswana's big night, because they had two world-class 400 guys. They had Amos, a world-class 800 guy. They would have looked at this program a week ago and said, we could win. We're dreaming of three medals on one night at the World Champs. And they got a fourth or fifth, and it did not start. Got a feel for Botswana.
Let's talk a bit about that, because we are going to move on to that 400-meter final. But it was, as you suggested, a very difficult time for the Botswana. The big controversy, if you can call it that, is that Isaac Makwala, who was probably the nearest challenger to Wade van Niekerk for the gold medal, ends up being not allowed to start by the IAAF medical officials, because he's, apparently, according to them, he's reported to the doctors that he's sick. He's got this gastrovirus, which is doing the rounds at the World Championships. He arrives at the start. He actually arrives at the start of the race. They don't let him compete. He then goes onto Facebook. He says, I really am feeling fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I was never sick, blah, blah, blah. I suppose we chatted a bit before this podcast and saying that, you know, I understand the IAAF's position. Why make other athletes sick when he's presented himself as sick? But what is the other way of looking at it?
There was a lot of fog of war, you know, the way that it came out yesterday caused part of the controversy, because it's a big mess, because and that doesn't mean I'm sitting here in judgment of either the IAAF or Makwala or anyone saying who's right or who's wrong, but just it's clear that the way that it was handled was incorrect, and that includes from the perspective of the media, because there was a lot of speculation and conspiracy theory and so on going around as well. You can understand the IAAF's predicament, because you've got a highly contagious virus among a group of athletes who are only on Tuesday. We've still got almost an entire week of this thing to go. If that thing runs through the event, by the time we get to Friday, Saturday, half the medalists might have been eliminated from the competitions. So they're in a situation where they now have a set of facts. The problem for Makwala is that no one's tested him for the specific virus, because it takes too long. It would take, even if it took him 24 hours, it's too late to prevent exposure. So the IAAF are reliant on much more rudimentary examinations, symptoms and history. Who have you been in proximity with? Are you staying at the same hotel? There's a few athletes there, we know have it. It's already been identified as this specific virus, so we know that it's likely if the symptoms match. And Makwala is showing those symptoms. Okay, so now Makwala could say my throwing up and nausea and being sick is not related to a virus. prove to me that it is, but they don't have the time. So
yeah,
it's very difficult in this situation.
So
I have some sympathy for the IAAF in the terms of the medical process that they would have taken to get to the point of diagnosing him as having a virus. I'm still of the opinion that even with a virus, an athlete can compete without being a risk to other athletes if you just take a few simple steps to eliminate that risk. So there is a baseline risk of infection. I mean, you and I have sat in proximity to one another for the last week. You could have easily infected me because you got sick because your daughter's sick or your wife or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so there's always some risk. Now, obviously, with this virus there's increased risk. But certain steps, like excluding Mukwala from the call room, this is where once the athletes are finished on the warm-up track, they come into a contained room where basically they check everyone's present and accounted for, numbers, bibs, securely fastened, everyone here, off you go.
Yeah.
I believe that you could eliminate the risk to other athletes by simply bypassing certain steps in the process where Mukwala is in contact. Just check that if he's using public bathrooms, that no other athletes are using them before they've been cleaned and sterilized. Just make sure that he's not in close proximity to other people who he might infect. I just don't think that if you... Because pulling an athlete from a race that is a final, in which he is a potential medalist, is a severe step. And if that step isn't evidence-based and proportional and absolutely necessary, to me it's too extreme. So I would have liked to see a little bit of discretionary compromise, as it were.
I suppose, I mean, when it comes to an event like this, there's certain protocols that they can and cannot do. So they probably don't have a protocol for something like this.
No, they don't. And so they were reliant on the UK public health... What's called a public health policy, but it's basically a guideline which recommends that the athlete be kept away from other people. Or not the athlete, the person. This is a public health document.
Yeah.
And the IAAF seem to have made that compulsory. So again, there's a medical aspect to, has he been diagnosed? And is there due process on the medical side? And the answer is probably not, but I understand why. So I wouldn't criticize the IAAF. Then there's a governance side where you're going to apply your medical finding to deny an athlete his opportunity, and I feel for him because you know you probably think Mukwala is a new kid on the block and he's young and he'll have other chances. He's 31.
Yeah,
like I didn't realize he was in his
30s. Probably his championships.
It could well be his shot at it. You know, because
now
you're going to ask him to extend for two more years the peak that he's on now. It's very difficult to deal with, and it was also just poorly handled from the media and also the IAAF, I think.
Well, certainly sad news, but let's turn our attention to the winner, Wade van Niekerk. Yesterday, he was the overwhelming favorite going into the event, the world champion, the world record holder, the South African, 25 years old, being coached by a 70-plus-year-old lady from Bloemfontein here in South Africa, and an amazing story, but absolute dominant performance. I think that the sad bit was is that it felt like he just finished the heat when he'd won the race. It was a little bit disappointing, I think, to some extent. His celebration was muted. I think that's the best. That's probably the understatement of the year.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you this because we can talk about the science and all this stuff as long as we want, but you're the media guy, and if you are clearly being positioned and marketed by the sport as the heir apparent to Usain Bolt, and there's a lot riding on you, and you are. I mean, if Fanica goes ahead and does what I think he will and wins this 200-400 double, he's the face of the games. He's the face of the Olympics in a couple of years' time. How do you manage that? How do you market that when he's going to lie down at the finish line? And I'm not saying that they've got to get him up there to go and dance and strike a pose and wrestle with the mascot and carry on like Usain Bolt used to do, but that's a tough sell because his personality is not...
No, not at all. And I mean, you know, you can't turn somebody into Bolt and you have to be authentic at the end of the day, but I agree with you 100%. There's an interesting article in the Guardian newspaper this morning, on the site, talking about the fact that, you know, if the IAAF and World Athletics are seeing Wade van Niekerk as the next Bolt, he's certainly, in terms of athletically, potentially that person. But in terms of the marketing, not at all. And it was a great description of talking about the fact that athletics over the last few years has been a tentpole business. where the tent pole is, as you say, in bolt.
Yeah.
And once that comes away, suddenly there's nothing left. And I, you know, you can't force Wade van Niekerk to be this extravagant person, but the irony is he's studying marketing and got a marketing degree, and it is probably the most, I can't say uncharismatic, that's the wrong thing to say, because he is, he's a shy individual, but you kind of want him to go, come on, man, just celebrate with a bit of vigor at the end. Instead, he just finishes it, and as you say, like from a media perspective, people love people who are going to create a bit of a stir, celebrate properly, and come up with a good quote, and you know, that is what makes the business. And we were talking about this before. There's a lot of money potentially being left on the table for Wade van Niekerk here, because sponsors do love personality. There's no doubt. And he will get support from his sponsors, I'm sure, because of his performances. But so much more is available to him if he just has a way of just upping his game on terms of the marketing.
And it's only in that in those moments, in those 10 minutes after events, because when he has appeared, from what I've seen in public events for sponsors, I see him on social media quite often, and he seems to have quite a large presence there.
Yeah.
And he's well spoken, he's intelligent, he's humble, which I like. I hate the bravado and machismo of some of the sprinters, and I quite enjoy that aspect of his personality. But I mean, do you reckon someone sitting there in the sponsors box, the VIP box, and he's finished the race, and they're like, there he goes, and he's going to lie down next, he's going to hug his family and coach and lie down. Do you reckon someone's on the walkie saying, like, get that guy up and get him around, tell him to smile? I mean, because he's not the only one losing money.
Absolutely.
IWF's losing too.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a lot riding on this. So I imagine that somebody will probably take him under their wing and say, look, we need to make your finishes slightly more excitable. And I think the telling moment was that almost as soon as the race had finished, they went straight to the pole vault, because there wasn't that celebration that everybody kind of expected. And, you know, the TV producers looking at this visual and saying, look, we can't have just a guy standing there looking like he's finished a heat. Let's go to the pole vault because it's more exciting there. And that was a telling sort of editing on the TV side that showed in a small way.
So, I mean, when Bolt didn't win the 100, comes third in the 100, he did a victory lap as though he'd won it in a world record. And Gatlin and Coleman, doping controversies and histories and stuff aside, for Gatlin, there's some degree of sympathy, because the guy who won it is basically in the background of everyone else's photographs, because the only guy people are interested in. Okay, so long story short, in 10 years' time, when Wade van Niekerk retires, does he get that victory lap? It's difficult to see. And as an athlete, he might well have achieved a career that's comparable to Bolt in a 4-2, which I dare say is a slightly more challenging range of events to do. But there's, it's frustrating, because he's so superior, but it feels like there's something being left on the table.
I was watching in my lounge, and my victory celebration was better than his in my lounge.
I think that's true for many in South Africa, actually.
Absolutely.
But maybe, you know, maybe without that personality, he's not the runner he is. And you turn him into a more of a showman, and he loses that, whatever he's finding to. I don't know.
Okay, I mean, there were just a sort of final word on this. We don't want to dwell on this too long, but it was a great moment in the semi-final when he was running and just kind of interacting with the runner on his outside as they were finishing down that final straight in the 200 meters. And it was a moment that actually made, you know, pictures on The Guardian and international newspapers because of that interaction. So, you know
what?
There is, maybe he just needs to be himself, but just let it out. You know, let
you
it
know
out.
What it might be, though? Is it might be that he's a little uncomfortable about the winning and the almost implicit arrogance that exists in the guy who celebrates winning. That he's been so parented and taught about humility and having respect for competitors that he actually can't bring himself to do that. Because you're right, I hadn't thought of that. In that moment, he's engaging, he's personable with the guy running next to him. Terrific. But when he wins, now he's in the spotlight. And maybe that's not quite... I'm sure he likes the spotlight, but I don't think he likes the spotlight for being the best. I don't think it sits well with his values. Maybe that's... I don't know. We're playing...
He comes from a very religious background. Anybody who follows him on his social media will see that. And he's a very devout individual. He's coach is, again, a very traditional Afrikaans lady who instills those values. So you're right. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to turn somebody like that into a Bolt. And we're not expecting that.
But, no.
I guess the frustration is...
We're playing Dr. Phil now, so maybe I should stick to science. We should talk about...
We should both stick to science.
Because there's some interesting things about the way Wade van Niekerk runs compared to his predecessors, the world record holder Johnson, which I thought were quite interesting scientifically.
Well, let's talk a bit about that.
So I saw an analysis the other day. There was a really terrific article in the New Yorker. This is our recommended reading for the day, folks. It's if you search for Niekerk Sprinting New Yorker, you'll find it. It's an article by, I think, Charles Bethea. And in it, he links to a couple of studies looking at an analysis of for Niekerk versus Johnson. And so Michael Johnson took 181 steps when he broke the world record in 1999. How many do you think for Niekerk takes in a race?
Was this 141?
Yeah, 181 steps
so
for Johnson.
So I would say for Niekerk is a lot less, probably 150?
Not bad, actually. Yeah. It's 163.
Okay.
And so that's quite a significant difference between the two of them, for considering that they're not too dissimilar in height. And so Johnson is a high-frequency sprinter, and for Niekerk is a high stride-length sprinter, which is quite interesting. And so one thing about that is interesting, is that, and I did it yesterday as well, when he broke the world record per 100 meters, 43 steps, 38, 40, 42.
Okay.
Last night, 43, 38, 40, 42. Exactly the same.
Okay.
Exactly
what is
the
that
same
telling?
In the steps. It tells us that he was a second slower last night, not because his stride length was any different, but because his stride frequency was slightly longer.
Okay.
Or slower.
Yeah.
So is he spending more time on the ground, maybe? But his leg turnover, for whatever aspect of turning over the legs, was a little bit slower.
He also eased up at the end, I guess, as well.
So he probably cost himself 0.2 or more or less, maybe 0.1 at the finish. So it's interesting because sprinting performance is a product of how long each step is multiplied by how quickly you take those steps, right?
So which is cadence.
Stride rate cadence versus and stride length. And so it gets interesting because with fatigue, both of those are affected. Because a fatigued muscle and a fatigued brain doesn't activate the muscle as much. So you spend longer on the ground and you spend less time in the air. Your stride length gets shorter. And that's almost a segue to the 400 hurdles, which is the fun thing. Because the problem with a hurdle is that if your stride length shortens, you're in trouble because there's a hurdle on the way and you might find yourself at the wrong distance from that hurdle to clear it.
Let's move to that because tonight is the 400 meter hurdle final.
Yeah.
The greatest 400 meter hurdler of all time was probably Ed Moses, the American. You know, I think he was unbeaten for something like 15 years or something like that. Talk about it is a very technical event.
Yeah.
What is the strides that these guys do and how does it affect that particular event?
So it's technical because obviously there's the act of hurdling, which is more technical than simply running flat.
Yeah.
But then imposed upon that is fatigue because it's over 400. And so that exponentially amplifies the technical challenge because as we were just saying with Niekerk, and you see it in his race, is he's taking more and more strides per 100 because his stride length is getting shorter and shorter as he fatigues over the course of the race. So a 400 meter hurdler has a challenge now because if you... So the hurdles are 35 meters apart. Now, Edwin Moses was famous because he used to take 13 steps between hurdles.
And he was a tall guy, though.
And he was a tall guy with a long stride.
Yeah.
Kevin Young, who's the world record holder and the only guy under 47 seconds in history, took 12 steps between two of the flights of hurdles when he broke that world record. Only guy ever to have included a 12-step period in a hurdle race, a legit hurdle
so
race.
So really long strides,
and
effectively.
They used to call him Spider-Man. He had legs, I mean, crazy. So anyway, so if you take an odd number of steps, then you can hurdle off the same leg every single time.
Yeah.
So 13 between hurdles means left leg over every single hurdle.
Yeah. Which is natural.
If your stride length gets shorter and you can no longer take 13 but you need 14, you have to change legs.
Okay.
And you have to
basically learn to hurdle with both legs.
Right, so you have to be equally skilled. And there have been some famous sprinters, a German called Schmidt who used to do that, and he was very good at it. Some other people can't do it. And so tonight, the world number one guy in the final this evening is Kieran Clement. Who is the Olympic champion, former world champion, and maybe the favorite, he cannot hurdle left leg first. So when you watch him, he goes right leg over every single hurdle.
All right.
And so he is obliged, because of that, to get 13s or 15s.
Yeah.
And so Clement is known, and I've noticed this actually, is he's either going to be good or he's going to be at the back.
Yeah.
And if he messes that stride pattern up because he can't hit the 13s or the 15s, then he ends up at the back.
Mm.
So his race is made or broken by his ability to execute. And he's not unique.
Yeah.
It's this case for all of them because at some point they make a decision that the hurdle is going to be out of reach on 13.
Mm.
So therefore, do I go 15 or do I try 14 and alternate?
Mm.
So it becomes quite technical in that regard. And it's interesting to see because there's a lot changes in the final 120 meters off the last three hurdles because people's race starts to fall apart.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that last sort of third of the race, that's when the stride length becomes more frequent. Or those top guys maintaining that stride length throughout the race, right to that final 100 meters.
Ed Moses used to do it. Kevin Young did it, except he did, as I said, the two flights at 12. So he was 19 to the first hurdle, 13, 12, 12, and then he finished on 13s.
Okay.
Moses used to go 19 to hurdle one, and then 13s the whole way.
Mm.
Most of the sprinters now are increasing the number of steps at the in the latter part of the race.
Mm.
So they'll start on 13s and finish on 15s.
Yeah.
And so it becomes interesting because it's not simply a physiological test.
Yeah.
But the technical execution relies upon the physiological capacity.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the toughest events. I mean, it's the man killer they called it.
Sure. So tonight, if you're watching that 400-meter hurdle final, have a look for the American Kieran Clement. He is going to be looking at that. He only goes, as Ross has just said, only goes over his right leg. If he goes over the left one, he probably thinks he's going to lose the race. We'll have to see, but he probably won't.
No, he won't. What he'll do instead is he'll try and
double tap.
10 meters. 10 meters from the hurdle, he'll realize I'm in trouble here. Yeah. I've asked more than my physiology can provide, and he'll have to squeeze in two quick ones, and that's when they lose so much momentum. Yeah.
So Kieran Clement will be watched by the world tonight because we're watching his stride pattern.
And all of them. So there's some, the middle lanes will be the ones to watch. Clement, Warholm, Samba from Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where usually the action comes. But look for big changes in the last 120 meters because someone's going to get it wrong.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fascinating event. Another one of the finals tonight is the women's 400 meters. Again, an enticing event. Tonight always feels like it's not as exciting as last night, mainly because we had those big 800 steeplechase 400 meters, and from a South African perspective, we're particularly interested in the 400. But the women's 400 tonight, again, interesting.
That event could be one of the highlights of these champs, actually.
Yeah.
You say it's not that exciting, but that 400 for women in Rio was a big talking point. And it was one of the best finishes of the games because Shawna Miller, now Miller Weibo of Bahamas, went off hell of aggressively, probably too much.
Mm.
And Alison Felix, who's obviously the darling of Nike in the USA and hence, well, by virtue of Nike, the world, she came back at her and she was gaining on her in the last 30 meters. And desperate times for Miller, she launched herself over the line. I don't know if you remember that. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Remind me. You'll find photographs, folks, on the internet. Look for Miller Felix Finish Rio, and you'll find pictures in fact, it's a YouTube. I'll post it on Twitter later today. The IOC have actually made that available. You can see it. Mm. She's literally horizontal, at her upper body over the line.
Mm.
And then the Americans all said it was unfair and not unethical, but against the spirit of the sport to dive across the line because obviously Felix is beaten.
Yeah.
And my argument is if diving across the line wins you the medal, then Felix not doing it by Felix is stupid on her part. She should have dived
Quite
too.
Difficult to dive across, actually,
no,
and get that right.
You don't wanna... So Tori Bowie, who won the 100, she didn't dive, but she was leaning and then she overbalanced and fell.
Mm.
She pulled out of the 200,
apparently
because of that dive.
Really? So she injured herself?
Well, that's the story. Initially, it came out that she'd had a stomach bug, the same one affecting everyone else.
Yeah.
But then people clarified and said, no, in fact, it was just because she's recovering from the fall.
Mm. Mm.
So that's why you don't dive.
Mm.
But anyway, it was a big controversy about nothing.
Mm.
But that's a rematch tonight. Miller, Felix, they both won. Well, Felix didn't win a semi, but she would have.
Mm.
She eased up too much. They will be... That's going to be good to finish tonight's program. So look for that.
So just a final comment. I mean, are we halfway through the world champs now? I suppose we are almost.
Yeah.
And it finishes on Sunday. The one thing it kind of seems to be a theme of these championships is that there's suddenly sort of a new breed of athlete coming through. And what we're not seeing so much is the dominance of the traditional sporting nations. And we've seen nations like Botswana coming through. South Africa, you know, we're obviously biased here, but when I think of all the stories that have happened so far, we've got the gold medalist in the long jump and the bronze medalist. We had potentially a double gold medalist in Caster Semenya. She got the bronze in the 1500. She's a good chance for the 800. We've got Wade van Niekerk. You look at the Botswana potential. Obviously, that's been a bit muted since yesterday. But is there a changing of the guard in terms of world athletics and the powerhouses? And if so, why is that? Why could it be?
Ivory Coast winning medals.
Yeah,
in the women's 100.
Yeah.
They had a men's finalist as well. Mm. I don't know if there is, first of all. Mm. It would be really interesting to look at because I share that impression.
Mm.
Certainly Jamaica has had one of their less successful championships. The USA, we said yesterday, never not been a medalist in the 110 hurdles, didn't medal this time. So it's possible that it's changing a little bit.
Mm.
It's also possible that we're just seeing random variation and perhaps we're being misled by our own biases because, as you point out, some of it is homegrown and so on. So it would make for an interesting analysis to look at the number of nations getting finals, the number of nations getting medals, the spread of medals, you know, how many. So if anyone wants to do that, feel free.
I would,
but I don't have the time. But if you send it to us, we'll credit you.
It was a great stat. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a great stat after the Rio Olympics last year, looking at what the most successful nation in the world in terms of the Olympics was based on population.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think New Zealand was the winner.
Yeah.
Historically. Yeah. You know, you look at in the size of the population, how many medals did they produce? New Zealand was the top performer.
Yeah.
I've got a theory about it, and we'll you can certainly agree or disagree here. Is it not because particularly in the big nations like Jamaica and the United States and the UK, that there is so much competition in other sports, taking athletes potentially away from track and field, and that track and field has a problem in bringing and making the sport as glamorous as maybe in the States. You've got basketball, you've got all sorts of other sports that are massively high paying. That the reason why the smaller nations are coming through because there's less talent going into those sports in the big nations. That's the only thing I can think of that potentially is affecting it.
Less talent going into the track and field. In those smaller nations.
Yeah. No, in the bigger nations. So if you're American,
right, because of the competition.
And you're an athletically gifted child at school, are you going to go into basketball or baseball where you can earn millions of dollars, or are you going to go in track and field where you're potentially earning powers the most?
Well, I've said before that if the NFL didn't scout so aggressively and pay so well, the 100-meter world record would probably have been where it is now 10, 15 years before, because I reckon a lot of the guys who get pulled to play football are potentially as athletic as anyone we saw in the 90s. So that's definitely a factor. I wonder whether in the Ivory Coast, where arguably football's the national game, I wonder how many Ivorian footballers would have been potential medalists in the 100 meters as well. You know, Nigeria, Ghana. I wonder if you could make the same case. I don't know. One thing that might have brought that, if that's the case, one thing that might have brought that to light is that globalism or globalization, as in the spread of knowledge and access to resources around the world, may have finally given those previously under-resourced countries that perhaps in the 90s and in the 2000s had the genetic or the innate abilities but didn't have the opportunities. Perhaps they've now been able to marry those two key things together.
Yeah.
Because 90% of it is best athletes with best support services, coaching, medical, scientific.
Yeah.
And that would not have existed in many of those countries. And I wonder if dedicated efforts plus just normal progression have finally brought those two things together. And
maybe the Ivorians have been downloading digital copies of Runner's World, and that's why they've improved their performance.
Well, remember the Kenyan javelin thrower who won a world title? Having taught himself on YouTube.
Yes, okay.
He learns,
great example.
He learns the sport on YouTube. Now, 20 years ago, that doesn't happen, right? Yeah. So, okay, and that's one swallow does not make a winter, but that's an example of I think, how the world is getting flatter in that respect. And interestingly, we've got a question which sort of feeds into that. Andrew Smith has asked, why do we have heats at the World Championships? Why not use the Diamond League as the heats and then World Champ consists of only finals? And the short answer to that is because the Diamond Leagues are constrained to only 8 or 9 guys per race. So you would never expose the next level of athlete from Botswana, from Morocco, from the Ivory Coast, even USA and Jamaica. They wouldn't get in there.
Yeah.
And so the reason we have a World Championships is access to the sport and opportunities to earn national colours and then go. Because in other words, the funnel's not wide enough through Diamond League. And so it needs to be widened by having nations compete in trials and then go to Worlds. That's the simple answer to that.
Well, we hope that this podcast and all the excitement that you've seen over those last few days at the World Championships will help bolster the sport and get more of the youngsters. If you are one of those youngsters listening, stay in the sport of track and field. It is absolutely a glorious place and a wonderful sport, and there's so much passion involved in it. We've seen that during these World Championships. And if you're from a small nation, it just proves that you don't need to be at a place where there's massive facilities. If you're a runner, you can train anywhere, as Kenyans have proved for years. That's all pretty much for us today. Final thoughts for tonight, Sir Ross, ahead of the finals?
Yeah, the women's 400, I'm looking forward to that head-to-head. There are very few head-to-heads like this in the World Champs. Last night we might have seen one, but the virus and the controversy denied it. Tonight you get your shot. And then that hurdles, have a look for who. And we'll count. I'll count the steps and we'll talk about that in tomorrow's
podcast. We'll do it in slow motion.
Yeah.
See who wins.
Very good.
So don't forget to interact with us on Twitter as well. Runners World SA is on Twitter. And of course, Ross is at Science of Sport. And you can also ask us questions on our Facebook page as well. We have had quite a lot of interaction. And a big thank you to everybody who has participated in the discussions. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 o'clock South African time, which will be 9 o'clock UK time. Feel free to be involved with us then. The podcast will be up on our Facebook page and on our site a bit later on today if you just want to listen to us and not look at our faces. But until tomorrow, we'll see you tomorrow.
Very good. Ciao.